This is Steve Maxer conducting an interview with Mr. Gonzalo Baltazar on the 23rd of March 2001 at approximately 11:40 a.m. Lubbock time. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, and Mr. Baltazar is in Denver, Colorado. Sir, why don't we go ahead and begin by you telling us a little bit about your early life, in particular when and where you were born and where you grew up.
Okay, I was born in November 1915, November 11th. And grew up in a small town of northeast Colorado called Fort Morgan. And was a family of farmers. My dad farmed some land up there in different parts of Morgan County. And there was 14 of us that grew up there. Had three brothers die and a sister, so ended up 10 of us growing up on the farm, farming, family operated farm.
Mm-hmm.
And went to different schools because we kept moving around to leasing different farms.
Mm-hmm.
And that's about it. We just, that's how we grew up.
Mm-hmm.
At 17, I quit school and joined the Army.
Mm-hmm.
And the only reason for that is just that I think I just needed more discipline in my life at the time, because I was kind of headed the wrong direction.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I ended up in towards the Army.
Mm-hmm. And that was in 1969?
Right, 68.
I'm sorry, 68, that where you entered the Army.
Right.
Now, just out of curiosity, while you were growing up, what were the principal crops that you guys, that your family farmed?
We farmed sugar beets was the main cash crop,
mm-hmm.
Corn, hay, and wheat and pinto bean.
Okay.
All irrigated land.
Mm-hmm. And let's see, where did you fit in to your family in terms of within the children?
I was the youngest.
You were the youngest?
Right.
Wow. When you were going to school, was there a particular subject that you enjoyed?
Oh, yeah, I was a history buff.
Okay.
I liked history classes.
Mm-hmm.
Also. I enjoyed that. I read a lot about U.S. history.
Mm-hmm. And did you engage in sports and stuff like that, too? Or?
Yeah, we was a family of wrestlers.
Mm.
And they still are. All mm-hmm. my nephews are still involved in it.
Okay. And when you decided to go into the military, to go into the Army, what did you understand at that point concerning the Vietnam War? And
you know,
of course, by the time you went in 1968, it was a pretty. The war was in full swing. We
right.
had a lot of people on the ground, a lot of news footage and everything else.
Yeah, you know, I didn't pay much attention to that. I didn't. I knew there's a war going on, but I really didn't pay much attention at that time because I was kind of involved in other things, just running around and all that. So when I joined, I really didn't think about me going to Vietnam. I just thought I was just going to the Army and serving a couple of years. So it didn't even dawn on me I'd be in any kind of combat or even get close to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you went in, and you talked to the recruiter, did they talk to you about specific jobs that you might want to apply for, or did you go straight in for infantry?
No, I just went, signed up for the draft,
mm-hmm.
volunteer draft, and there's no recruiter to talk to. They just process it through,
mm-hmm.
and when we got to basic, there's no kind of talk about what we wanted to do or anything. We just did our basic training,
mm-hmm.
you know, in the first 3 months. So there's nothing was explained to us about trying to get in different fields of jobs and all that.
Mm-hmm.
So then I went to KIT training, Advanced Infantry Training,
mm-hmm.
at Fort Gordon, Georgia. We went to a little camp outside of there called Camp Crockett.
Mm-hmm.
They said we'd be infantry then. It started dawn on me, but infantry. I said, well, you know, this means combat and all that, you know. Mm-hmm. And it was pretty tough training,
mm-hmm.
both basic and advanced infantry training.
Now, where did you do your basic?
In El Paso, Texas, Fort Bliss, Texas,
mm-hmm.
in El Paso, which was grueling.
Mm-hmm. Now, before we talk about basic, I'm curious, when you went in, you said you stopped, you quit school.
Right.
And you were still 17, right?
Right.
Did your parents have to sign?
Yeah, my dad had to sign.
Okay. Did he try to talk you out of it at all, or did?
Yeah, he did. He just he said I was crazy, you know.
Mm.
And he knew what was going on, you know. And
mm-hmm.
I just kind of ignored it about the war and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So he signed for me finally after I insisted I wanted to go.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it.
Okay. Did you have any other brothers that had gone to the military?
Yeah, I had, there's seven of us went in the military.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, we all served our time and got out.
Mm-hmm.
I was the only one that actually went to Vietnam and was in combat, any kind of combat.
Out of all seven of you, you were the only one that went to Vietnam.
Right.
Amazing.
Yeah. But see, I think I was the youngest one.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the oldest one is 20 years older now.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they went to different places, you know. They went Korea, Germany, Japan,
mm-hmm.
and unfortunately, I went to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, why don't you go ahead and talk a little bit about basic. In particular, what did you find, for instance, to be one of the most more challenging aspects of basic training for you?
Basic was a negative for me. It was. It was pretty tough, you know. They ran us to the ground all the time, to exhaustion. We were beat. We were beaten up quite a bit. In basic, the drill sergeants actually were hitting us. We did a lot of low crawling just for punishment out in the desert, you know. And we did our basic stuff and learning how to shoot our weapons. At the time, it was M14 and basic. And learned our other stuff, grenade throwing and bivouac, which is 2 weeks out in the field in tents.
Mm-hmm.
And just learned some maneuvers, you know. But everything just learning how to fire weapons and mostly just grenades and rifles.
Mm-hmm.
And there was 13 of us from a hometown that we all went in together the same day, which was a big thing because it's a small town.
Mm-hmm.
So we was all together in basic. So we, you know, we all grew up together and went to school. So it was we all experienced the same thing in our basic. And trying to find out all our company was the most grueling company in the whole basic training camp.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because we were, like I say, we was beat a lot, disciplined constantly.
Mm-hmm.
Or it was just for no reason. We just, you know, they wanted to show you who's boss and teach us, you know. Discipline.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't a very good experience.
And when you talk about physical contact between you and your trainers, what was it typically?
Hitting.
Mm-hmm.
Hitting us with their batons.
Mm-hmm.
I had one instance where on an M14, it's called a gas cylinder on there. It had to be loose. And mine was, you know, I was always checking mine, make sure it was loose where you can push it up and down.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when inspections came by and they inspect our rifles, and the drill sergeant swore it wasn't loose, so he hit me between the eyes with the butt of my weapon.
Mm.
And, you know, of course that knocked me down, and actually I still have the scar from it.
Wow.
So it was things like that, you know. There's a lot of fights going on. We had a couple of boxes in my platoon where drill sergeant went up behind one of these guys and hit him for no reason at all from behind, and the boxer turned around and nailed him, knocked him down.
Mm-hmm.
And it was forgotten about because the drill sergeants knew they couldn't report this because then they had to report why this happened.
Mm-hmm.
So they, not realizing that this was wrong, we never reported it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because if we would have reported this to the inspector general, they would have gotten in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so when things like that happen, where a drill sergeant would get beat up, and then nothing would be said.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they also stole our money. Took our money from us, you know. They lied to us. They would be charged for this and that, and so that $98 a month we were getting paid. Well, we had no money, even after we got paid, because they stole it from us. So that was, like I say, a negative part of my Army career.
Mm-hmm. And they would just, how would they take your money?
They come in the barracks on payday,
mm-hmm.
and they would say, you all have to throw in this kind of money because, you know, you did bad, you know, on this grill, or you didn't do very well in your marching grill, and you're getting fined. And one time, this drill sergeant claimed he was in trouble because of us, and he's getting fined for it. And it's up to us to pay that fine, and we had to give him all our money. And turned out this was just a lie. He just killed his, you know, making money off it.
Mm-hmm.
And like I say, we was only getting paid $98 a month.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that left us with nothing.
Oh.
And he was living a good life.
Have you talked to other soldiers that had similar experiences that weren't necessarily in the same unit as you were?
Yeah, because we had one friend that, there's 13 of us, actually 14 total, but he was held back for one day because he had a medical problem that they wanted to check out.
Mm-hmm.
So they sent him down, and he ended up in a different company.
Mm.
And we talked to him and his friends about it, they had nothing like this. Nothing at all. They weren't beat. They didn't have their money taken from them. It was just, they just went through a basic training.
Mm-hmm.
Like they're supposed to go through.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we would see them every once in a while, their company, when we was out there, and they were having a good time, you know, and we were learning what they're supposed to learn. And we was all just grueling. Ours was grueling. When they make us low crawl, out in the desert, they make us crawl for hundreds and hundreds of yards, or to the point where the insides of our knees were raw. You know, we were bleeding, and they were raw. And I've witnessed drill sergeants pick up guys and slam them back down on the ground, just saying they weren't low, you know, because they said they weren't low crawling right. But so it was just them showing their power.
Mm-hmm.
You know. And, you know, to this day, if I ever had to go through it again and I knew about this, then I'd report these guys. But,
mm-hmm.
but we were scared. I was 17. I was scared half to death once I got in there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so were the others.
Wow.
And then we met other guys from a town near us that were in basic training in a different company, and they had nothing like that. Nothing like that happened to them.
Okay.
So that's why we knew everything was wrong.
Yeah. Now, did you, you said you got trained on the M14.
Yeah.
Did you get introduced to the M16 during basic at all?
No. We got introduced to the M16 in advanced infantry training.
Okay. And that was where you said outside of Fort Gordon, Georgia?
Right. Camp Crockett. Called Camp Crockett.
Okay. What were the differences between your advanced training and your basic training?
We trained a lot with the M16, all the weapons, the big weapons, the M72 LAWs, the anti-tank weapons, all the Claymores, all the big weapons, you know, the M60, M50, and we did a lot of maneuvers, you know, training maneuvers, how to fight group guerrilla warfare.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a lot of combat training. It was a big difference from the basics.
Now, when you say guerrilla warfare, do they actually use that expression and do they talk about fighting against the Viet Cong and whatnot?
Yes. Uh-huh. Yes, and they were split. Yeah, they were split us up. Some of us would be the VC, and we'd be fighting against, you know, the Americans, you know, the actual maneuvers, you know, without the real bullets, obviously. Mm-hmm. And it was pretty good training.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at night, they'd have us out there at night trying to sneak up on the Americans. I was on the enemy side. Sneaking up on the Americans and doing night raids and things like that. So it was a lot of good good training, good information. A lot different from basic. And we was treated pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
But we worked very hard.
Now, did you... when you were going through this training, did the instructors talk about the specific experiences they themselves had from Vietnam?
Yeah, we had not all of them were in Vietnam. We had a couple that were in Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
and they talked about their experience. Some were involved in a lot of combat, and some weren't. Just they were. Like in tank companies, that they weren't involved in that much combat. And, they'd warn us that if you don't listen, you're going to die. And you know, they put a little scare into you.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a bit scary. I mean, they talk some sense into you that make you understand that you know we're going over to fight, and if you don't pay attention, you know, and be a team player, you know, you might not make it back.
Mm-hmm.
And it said that some won't make it back.
Mm-hmm.
Some of you here won't make it back. And towards the end, they would tell you that make sure you have your will written out if you have anything, but make sure you have a will and your life insurance straightened out before you go over. And that was right probably a week before we finished the training.
Mm-hmm.
So it was starting to get in a rude awakening that maybe you weren't going to come back.
Okay. Now, did you, was it similar in basic in terms of the instructors having Vietnam experience?
The only one that we knew had Vietnam experience was our company commander. And he, all he did is read what happened to him. He won awards and medals over there. And his face was burned up a little bit. And that was it. That's all.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't tell us much about Vietnam. They just told us about training.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're just more into teaching us discipline
mm-hmm.
and beating us.
mm-hmm. Okay. And when you finished your AIT, did you feel like you were prepared to take on the world, take on the Vietnamese?
Yeah, you know, I thought it was. You know, most guys around there thought that they were trained well enough to be combat ready.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you kind of get brainwashed into that you're a real fighting machine, a soldier, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then realistically, you weren't ready for it. Because you knew all how to use all your weapons, you know, your booby traps, your claymores, and all your big weapons. You know how to do all that, but in actual combat, it was a totally different story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you just didn't use go by the book anymore. You know?
Mm-hmm.
As you learn as you went along in Vietnam.
Now, when did you graduate from AIT?
March.
About March 69?
Yeah, that was in basic. I finished basic March 8th in May. May of 69. And then about July of 69, I finished AIT.
Okay. And then you found yourself...
They assigned me to an armament company in Fort Hood, Texas, because I was too young to go to Vietnam yet.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just what it was. It was a return Vietnam return base, mm-hmm. for, you know, Vietnam returnees. So I was just stuck in with a lot of nothing but Vietnam veterans. Because
mm-hmm.
I was just on their way home. You know, they were just stationed there until their time was up. So I was stuck there for maybe 2 months,
mm-hmm.
and didn't do very much down there, because all they did was play ball and whatever, you know. They were just Vietnam vets that they didn't want to mess with, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I just I had it easy for 2 months, and then my orders came down to Vietnam, and it was the orders that we had to go. I had to go to air base outside of Fort Hood called
mm-hmm.
Robert Gray Air Force Base. And that's where we'd be training a special with a special unit that was getting reactivated for Vietnam, and it was a special unit that we trained for probably 8 months. And we were training to be rapid reaction air rifle platoon, which our job was our main job was to rescue shot down pilots. Chopper pilots and jet pilots, and that was our main job, and also a recon. So we trained for a solid 8 months, approximately. You know. And
okay, so this was from July 68 to February
69. Mm-hmm.
During that time period, the training that you received, was it being supervised by Vietnam veterans?
A lot of them were Vietnam vets. A lot of guys that were training with us in my platoon were Vietnam vets. You know, they're kind of like our leaders.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they help us out and what to expect. And this helped with the training. And they went with us back over to Vietnam to
mm-hmm.
do their second and third tours.
Wow. Now, how did they refer to the Vietnamese?
As what do you mean?
Would they say, well, when you encounter the Vietnamese, or would they say... How would they literally, verbally refer to the Vietnamese, the Viet Cong?
You mean like groups and things?
Yeah, or did they just call them VC or Charlie?
Charlie most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is all, yeah, more or less is always Charlie. Charlie can do this, Charlie can do that. That's how they refer to them mostly.
Mm-hmm.
You know. Some of the hardcore guys, you always use goops or dinks, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the term for them.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly, like Charlie, everything who was taught, Charlie does this, Charlie does that.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
And did you feel that the training you received during that period, from July 68 to February 69, was more realistic and better?
Yeah, I think it was, because, like I said, they had veterans, you know, veterans in there, and they pretty much knew what they expect, and
mm-hmm.
we trained to repel other choppers, McGuire, and we was trained McGuiring. All of us infantry guys are trained as door gunners also, just in case we needed as door gunners on choppers,
mm-hmm.
and radio. Obviously, radio techniques, how to use radio and all the language you use on the radio, what kind of language,
mm-hmm.
and the terms, different types of terms. And it was a lot of good training. We did a lot of mic training out in the Fort Hood area.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, during that training, were you using an M16, M14?
Yes, it was an M16.
Okay.
And the M16 stayed with us
for
those 8 months in the also the year in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
So it was our baby for almost 2 years.
Okay. Which one did you prefer?
The M16.
Okay.
Yeah. And being I was a radio man, that's all I could carry anyway until I got rid of the radio.
Mm-hmm.
And guys were trained at M60s, and they were stuck with them forever, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Until their tour was up, or they were killed, or they got out of the infantry somehow.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So that unit you trained with, you all went over together?
Yeah.
To Vietnam?
Right.
And what size was the unit?
I'm going to guess around 400.
Okay. So about a battalion?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. It was infantry, it was Capitan, which are low observation helicopters, mm-hmm. and the Cobra outfit, mm-hmm. and the Slick outfit, the guys that airlifted us out to the jungle,
mm-hmm.
and maintenance, and all your maintenance people, radio and helicopter maintenance, and we was all together.
Mm-hmm. Now, at this point, were you in B Troop 2nd and 17th?
When we got there, it was called F Troop.
Okay, F Troop.
Yeah.
Okay.
And obviously they changed that for reasons, because remember the old movie F Troop?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they changed.
Not very glowing.
No.
Okay, so they changed, when you got in country, they changed it from F Troop to B Troop.
Right.
Now, how were you transported to Vietnam?
We all on regular commercial airline.
Mm-hmm.
We all went over there in, I don't know, two or three airlines,
mm-hmm.
all together. Some went over on the ship to guard all our equipment on the ship. And I was supposed to, but I got in a lot of trouble. I didn't get to go on the ship. I had to go by commercial airlines and by escort, as a matter of fact, because I got in too much trouble. You know, I was kind of a troublemaker.
Do you want to talk about that for a minute?
Well, it was getting close to our end of our training.
Mm-hmm.
And we went to the EM club, which was only a half a mile away up on a hill, you know, and the other side of the hill was an MP company. And, of course, they had a floor show once in a while, singers and dancers.
Mm-hmm.
And a fight broke out, and one MP come over and hit me on the head with a baton. And I turned around and smacked him, and then I realized it was an MP, and I sat back down, you know. And he come back at me and said, we're going outside. And I said, you know, I apologized to him. I said, no, it's a mistake. I don't know why you hit me. I was just sitting here anyway. And we ended up going outside. And long story short, I beat up five MPs and had to go through a court-martial and ended up with Article 15 because I put two MPs in the hospital.
Okay.
And I was supposed to go on the ship. I was supposed to go home for 30 days for R&R for vacation.
Mm-hmm.
And they cut me down to 9 days, and they said, you're not going on the ship anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So I went home for 9 days. I got in trouble at home because I beat up two policemen. Ended up in jail, and they transported me to Denver jail. And MPs came and got me there, took me out and escorted me down back to Fort Hood, or Robert Gray Air Force Base. And from then on, I had two officers escort me all the way to Vietnam.
Hmm.
So I was a troublemaker.
Okay. Did you, when you got to Vietnam, were you just let loose, or?
Yeah.
Were there any other?
No, turn me loose. My company commander says, okay, now you can go fight. I said, okay. He did get a letter. He did get a letter from the attorney, and I guess he called him district attorney,
mm-hmm.
down in my hometown, and said they wanted me back to for my remaining 30 days in jail. And my CO wrote back to him, said, you want him, you come and get him. And I never heard from him since. Yeah, so.
Mm-hmm.
So, and my CO was pretty good. He was pretty much my attorney when I got in trouble.
Hmm.
And when I beat up those MPs. So I think he just liked me because I had a lot of fight in me.
Okay. What was the morale of the unit like?
It was pretty good morale because, you know, when you train together for 8 months, you all become pretty good friends. And we all knew each other very well, and
mm-hmm.
we developed a very good trust in each other, and we knew who's going to watch your back and who wasn't going to watch your back. Cause we had a couple slackers that didn't want to go to Vietnam, obviously, and And as a matter of fact, we had a couple defectors just took off and didn't make it with it. One guy was from Mexico, and the last day before we left, he'd come back to the barracks, got his stuff, and he said he's going back to Mexico, and he tried to talk me into going back with him. So I said, no, you know, I got to come back to my country. You don't. You just go to Mexico, and I have no choice. So he just left, and you know, that was the last I seen of him.
Mm-hmm.
And we just had another guy that just defected. He left, and I never know whatever happened to him.
Mm-hmm.
So, but morale was very good, and throughout the whole company, because we all got to know each other, all of the, you know, the pilots and the maintenance. And
mm-hmm.
So when something happened, it hurt everybody.
Yeah. Was your unit primarily volunteers or draftees or a combination?
Well, it's kind of funny. Some were draftees. Some were troublemen in civilian life, and the judge gave them a choice, go to prison or go to Vietnam. So we had a lot of those. It was interesting. I had one guy that the judge, he killed a guy. He hit him, ran him over the car. So, it was, you know, it was murder. He did it. He did it on purpose. And the judge told him, Vietnam or prison.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, he chose prison. I mean, Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
So, and actually, he was one of the guys in our outfit that... he snapped, and he, you know, he couldn't handle the combat.
He couldn't?
No.
What happened to him?
He went AWOL. You know, we went through one big battle.
Mm-hmm.
Matter of fact, Hill 376.
Mm-hmm.
And he snapped it on that after that battle, and he went AWOL and went back home, on his way back home to Detroit. And he went to see a counselor up there, and they talked him into coming back to Vietnam, you know, and he came back, and the only thing happened to him is they made him a Jeep driver, you know, and with no discipline.
Wow.
So we had a few guys that were you know, they were troublemakers in civilian life.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So that was the difference between then and now. Now you got to have your... You had to be a high school graduate and all that. Back then, it took anyone, you know, criminal, you know.
Yeah. Now, in terms of the composition, the makeup of your unit, how would you describe it in terms of ethnicity?
Oh, black, I'm sorry.
Ethnicity? Ethnic background of people?
Yeah, we have a mixture.
Mm-hmm.
In our infantry outfit.
Mm-hmm.
Puerto Ricans, myself, I'm Mexican, a couple Mexicans, blacks. We had one guy, which I admire very much, named Detmar Schneider. He was from Germany,
mm-hmm.
and he wanted to serve the country and you know, do his part for the country since
mm-hmm.
he came from Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had a great deal of, we had different backgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
It was interesting.
How well did everyone get along?
Pretty well. There were some that didn't get along well. We had one guy ended up going to prison for 30 years because I still get different reports. He killed one of our sergeants with a grenade. Said he was going to get court-martialed because he just paid a direct order. And the sergeant was one of the witnesses.
Mm-hmm.
So, right before his court martial in Vietnam, he threw a grenade in the beach. And, I don't know I really don't know if he lived. You know, I thought he was killed, but he served 30 years. And he got out last year out of Berlin. So, some didn't get along. It was a racist thing. Or this one gentleman that got 30 years. He was black, and he had a lot of problems with race and everything. And he thought everybody was racist and prejudiced towards him.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of that in Vietnam. You know, and in our outfit, he was probably the only one that didn't get along with anybody, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it was probably a good thing that he ended up going to prison. There was just somebody you couldn't trust out in the field. Mm-hmm. You couldn't depend on him. And all the rest of us seemed to get along pretty well, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, there was a few that did snap, you know, that couldn't fight when we got in a firefight and just kind of froze and either ran or just froze.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it was a different thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, when you finally got in country and you got off the plane, what were your first impressions?
Hot. We got off the plane, it was hot. I thought going to Vietnam, and like I think most guys thought this too, since new guys had never been there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I always thought, well, geez, are we going to get off the plane fighting, you know? Are we going to have to run for cover when we get off this airline or what?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so once we got there, it was pretty scary to me, you know. It was hot, and then at night, our first night there, you hear the M60 guns going off at night, and you get a little worried because we didn't. All our weapons were on the ship, so I was getting worried. Well, you know, we didn't have guns or anything, our rifles. And I thought, what if we get overrun? Because you hear all the bombs going off and the fighting at night. So I was pretty nervous,
mm-hmm.
you know. And we was down at Da Nang. We landed at Da Nang,
mm-hmm.
and we was there for a couple of days till they shipped us all up north to our main base, which was at Camp Eagle, at Wei.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we get all our equipment back, you know, our rifles and everything we needed, and our new they built new hooches for us,
mm-hmm.
you know. And the first week or so, it consists nothing of filling sandbags and put them up around our hooch, you know, building up around our hooches, you know,
mm-hmm.
building our bunkers, you know. So we was pretty busy there.
Yeah. Now, what did you, when you got there, what did you think the United States was trying to accomplish in Vietnam?
We was trying to accomplish the free, keep communists out of South Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
keep it a free country. You know, I knew that, you know. So, you know, it went in realizing that we were fighting for these people,
mm-hmm.
you know. And that's pretty much all I knew. You know, I didn't realize all the politics involved in this war at the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so and then it as we went on in this in Vietnam, the time went on, I started to realize that it was just a battle to survive, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You weren't fighting for really anything, you were just fighting to stay alive until your time was up, and hopefully you made it back.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. It's kind of negative, isn't it?
Well, or so I guess some might argue it's realistic.
Yeah.
When did you actually first get out into the field?
April, first part of April, maybe the last part of March, I think. They sent us out for maneuvers for 2 weeks and recon. And we was out, you know, and I can't remember where we were at, but they sent us out in the jungle. And,
this is still out, you were based in Camp Eagle?
Yeah, we was based in Camp Eagle.
Okay, and so you're flying out into another area not too
right.
far away.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And
what was the primary mission of this?
Just recon, looking for any kind of activity,
mm-hmm.
you know, enemy activity.
Mm-hmm.
And just learning things. We was, some was by the ocean, by the sea, by the beach. We just up there, I think the first week, middle of the first week, I got bit in the eye by a scorpion. So,
you got bit where?
On the eye.
Eye?
Yeah.
Wow.
So I had to go to, they medevaced me out because I, you know, I got pretty sick.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up in the hospital for a while because it's swollen up pretty large, probably the size of a softball mine again.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was pretty amazing. You know, I took pictures of it because it's interesting, anything like it. But and then after that was over, they sent me back out to the field.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as I got back, this was our first 2 weeks. It was towards the second week. It was April 12th, but it was 69. We were going up a hill. And a low observation chopper called Lucha flew over. And he flew over us, and then he left. And pretty soon, we got hit with income. And killed a few of our guys, injured, wounded about 13 guys, killed a couple.
Wow.
It was our own artillery. This Loach was apparently a colonel flying this Loach that we were the NDA going up the hill, and we called artillery in on it.
Oh, for crying out loud.
Yeah. So that cut our platoon by, we ended up with 27 guys after that.
My goodness.
Yeah, so.
What was the original strength of your platoon?
I think it was like 52. Around there.
It's an overstrength platoon.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then you were cut down to about 28.
Yeah, and then eventually we ended up with about 22, I think it was. And we lost people. They wouldn't replace them because we could move a lot faster with just 22, you know.
Yeah.
Like, say, it was rapid reaction.
Right.
So if somebody gets shot down, we had to get out there before the Viet Cong got them or the NVA got to the pilots.
Right. Now, what kind of briefing or briefings had you received at this point, especially when you first got in country, about being in Vietnam, things to do, things not to do, and then when you started going out on your missions, what kind of briefings would you get?
You know, if I can remember right, we had some short briefings with some Special Forces and Green Beret guys.
Mm-hmm.
We train with them a little bit, and then they tell us what to expect. Out in the jungle, booby trap training,
mm-hmm.
What kind of booby traps to look for, what kind of booby traps they had, how to disarm the booby traps, what to do and what not to do. As far as you see something, don't kick it over, it might be a booby trap. They had Kit Carson scouts, which used to be Viet Cong or NVA that surrendered to our side and became our scouts for us. And they would teach us what booby traps they handmade,
mm-hmm.
what they would look like, and how to recognize a booby trap.
Because
if you're a point man or whatever, you have to look for this stuff. And we got a lot of good briefings from the Special Forces and the Green Berets and Kit Carson Scott. And obviously, and we trained more on retelling into the jungle and all that.
Okay. And what about briefings about, you know, things that you shouldn't be doing in terms of maybe interacting with Vietnamese people and stuff like that?
They brief us on the women,
mm-hmm.
of course, disease and all that. But see, we, they did a lot of that, but my outfit would never, we could never go to the town. We couldn't go to the villages because we was always on standby.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't have to worry about going into the villages, the infantry guys. Because
mm-hmm.
we was always on standby. We never had a, if you had a day off, you had a day off. They tell you you can do anything you want, but you couldn't go down to the village.
Mm.
So we didn't have to worry about women or interacting with the Vietnamese people.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of stealing. If you get a hoochie mama, where you clean your barrack. Your hooch, they steal a lot to make sure everything's okay. You don't do anything secure. But we never had any housemates. we just weren't allowed them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some other optics were, but we weren't. We was pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
We were disciplined pretty good.
Mm-hmm. Now, during the first 2-week mission, when you had to get medevac for your Scorpion bike,
mm-hmm.
and the and then the second one where the U.S. artillery was brought down on you, did you encounter any Vietnamese, either civilian or enemy?
No, never did.
Okay. Was this the did this become the routine for your unit in terms of your missions and operations?
As far as what?
I guess going out into certain areas like this, being flown out, going on 2-week missions,
yeah.
and then coming back?
Yeah, it was routine for us.
Mm-hmm.
We go out, there's times we recon a mountain, you know, we'd be out there for a week or two.
Mm-hmm.
And then if anything happened nearby, like somebody got shot down, they could pick us up and take us out there right away,
mm-hmm.
you know, wherever we was at.
Mm-hmm.
And we did a lot of that. We did a lot of blockades where the Marines or the Army would be sweeping down the beach area, and we'd be a blockade for the VC or MBA that are, so, you know, we catch them as they're coming down, running away from the sweeping.
Mm-hmm.
We did a lot of that, a lot of recon. We did go in a lot and pick up shot down pilots. I recovered a lot of helicopters that were shot down.
Mm-hmm.
A couple jets. We go out and jet pilots would tell us they're receiving fire from an M-51 at a certain position. We go in and knock it out, you know, so they wouldn't get shot down.
Mm-hmm.
And we did a lot of, it was a lot of action for our platoon.
Because
obviously when somebody gets shot down, the enemy's around.
Mm-hmm.
So there's always action. You're always getting a firefight, short firefight, some long firefight.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we captured a few VC,
mm-hmm.
a couple of VAs once in a while. So we was always it was always hot. You know, it wasn't like a straight leg infantry outfit. They go out and they have to jungle for weeks at a time and never run into a battle.
Mm-hmm.
And ours was a lot different. We was always encountering something. Yeah. Some kind of battle, or always running into NBA or BC.
Mm-hmm. Well, why don't you go ahead and describe the first time your unit engaged the enemy? That you remember.
I don't remember. It was kind of first time. It was kind of comical, I think. We was doing recon up in some ridge, and. I know my loads pilot, I was in contact, since I was a radio operator for the platoon leader, I'd always talk to the pilots, and the scouts would tell me what's coming up ahead, you know, and of course I reported. And the pilot said, you know, you have a Victor Charlie up ahead, you know, we spotted a Victor Charlie, and I said, a what? They said, a Victor Charlie. Victor Charlie. I said, VC? He said, yeah. I said, well, what's that? He said, you know, the enemy? Because I was only 17. And then realizing that we're going to have our first encounter with the enemy.
Mm.
I was kind of like, holy cow, you know, we're, you know, this is a real thing now.
Mm-hmm.
You know. So we kept going. And our machine gunner seen something in the corner of his eye, and he just turned and opened up on that spot.
Mm-hmm.
And what it was is he shot an MBA, and there's two MBA, no, VC. They were VC. He
mm-hmm.
shot one, and he killed one, and the other one, I think, was wounded, and he tried to drag him with him into the jungle,
mm-hmm.
you know, the thick jungle, and then a couple of our guys ran in after him, and he dropped his dead buddy, and he kept going. So we got the dead VC, and the other guy we couldn't find.
Mm.
So they tell me on the radio. My company commander tells me on the radio. He says, "Go back to the LZ, the landing zone." And he says, "And hurry, you know." And so I. know, I give the radio to my lieutenant, and next thing I know, we're running back to the LZ.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we got this deadly sea on our shoulder. You know, me and this other guy were dragging him, and because he wanted that body count, you know, he wanted to bring that body back.
Mm-hmm.
And we're dragging this guy, and we're in the getting to the LZ, which is a rice paddy, so there's, you know, we're trying to, you know, it's hard because we're sinking in, you know, with all this weight and everything we have on us. And we finally get on the chopper, and I mean, these door gunners are opening up, and we have the cobras opening up all around us. Well, find out that when we got out of there, there was, like, a company of NBA running down after us, you know, and that's why they told us to get out fast,
mm-hmm.
you know. So that was not my first experience, just kind of with the NBA and the NBC.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of scary.
Mm-hmm. Now, the person that you were carrying, this VC, was there anything that was, do you know if there was anything taken from him in terms of intelligence material?
He had about $3,000 on him. And we figured the intelligence thought maybe he was a tax collector,
hmm.
you know, and which to me, a tax collector is just, they're just DC that go inside the villages and they get paid by the village people to leave them alone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's, I mean, because there's no tax collectors up there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's, I just think he was the one that collected money to, so they'd be left alone.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that's all he had on him, mm-hmm. all that money.
You mentioned that you were, of course, the platoon leader's radio man,
mm-hmm.
and that you handed your radio off to him when you were helping to carry that body back. Was it typical for your platoon leader, your lieutenant, to go out there with you?
Yeah, he had to be with him.
Okay.
At all times. Okay. Our CO was the company commander. He always flew above us.
Mm-hmm.
He's the one that mostly directed us where to go.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we kept constant contact with him,
mm-hmm.
and the Loach pilot, the scout pilot. But, yeah.
Okay.
And he was, we went through several platoon lieutenants. Some got killed, some got wounded. Yeah. Some couldn't handle it.
Mm-hmm.
But the first one we had was probably the best one. Lieutenant Burke, which retired recently as a general.
I'm sorry, Lieutenant who?
His name was Lieutenant Burke.
Burke?
Charles Burke.
Okay.
Yeah. He was the best one
uh-huh.
we had, and then he was actually a pilot. And somehow he got talked into being a platoon leader because we didn't have one.
Uh-huh.
You know, this started back at Fort Hood.
Yeah.
And so he stuck with us in Vietnam for a couple months until they finally got an actual combat platoon leader.
Mm-hmm.
Infantry. And from then on, we kept going to different platoon leaders because we kept losing them or some were so gung-ho they get us in trouble, you know, because
mm-hmm.
we had a couple special forces platoon leaders, you know, and things like that. And that's why I kind of missed our Lieutenant Burke because he was pretty level-headed and,
mm-hmm.
you know, he kept his cool all the time.
Now, the gung-ho guys, how would they get in trouble?
When we get ambushed or something, or we receive fire from certain areas, you know, he wants us to just charge, you know, without thinking this through. So, well, we're charging, you know. And, well, you don't do that. You know, you actually do charge if you get ambushed. If it's a close ambush, you charge that position to get ambushed by, you know. But if it's just receiving fire from different areas, you don't charge that area, you know. You let the scouts check it out for you,
mm-hmm.
and you try to maneuver your way up there, you know, seek them out.
Mm-hmm.
Some of these guys are just a little crazy for us, you know. They just I don't know what the problem is. They blood and guts, they didn't care who got killed or anything.
Mm-hmm.
You had ways of fighting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you learn ways of fighting with DC and the NBA. So that was, and we lose those lieutenants,
mm-hmm.
I get a little crazy over the radio, like, you know, being out as a radio man, they'd be yelling on the radio, screaming this, screaming that, and I think STO realizing that this guy's out of control.
Mm-hmm.
I better find somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how we lose some. Like I say, some will get shot. Bring on the next lieutenant.
Mm-hmm.
There's a couple times that our sergeant, our senior sergeant would have to take over the platoon. You know. Because our lieutenant got shot.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm curious, you mentioned the fact that when you were finally on board the helicopter, having carried that dead VC
mm-hmm.
soldier to the landing zone, and then you realized or you found out that there was actually a company of NVA there,
yeah,
trying to catch you guys.
Yeah.
Did you at that point did you kind of pause and think, was it really worth this one body for putting your two lives in jeopardy just to carry one body back? For
yeah,
the count?
We at the time we didn't know it.
Right, but after the fact.
After the fact, yeah. If we would have known, I think even though our CO wanted us to drag this body back, I think I just would have dropped it and kept running to get out of there quicker. Because, you're putting a lot of people in jeopardy here. You got the pilots that might get shot up.
And
they get shot, we can't get out.
Mm-hmm.
Or if they get shot up in the air, we crash.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of things you're risking there just for one body.
Mm-hmm.
Heck, you always have plenty of time to get another body somewhere. So it was. You think about it. We thought about it later. I don't think it was worth it. I would have dropped him.
Mm-hmm.
I probably might have gotten a little discipline out of it. I wouldn't have cared. You got to think of your outfit. Because I was one of the last ones. Me and my buddy were one of the last ones to get on a chopper. Well, that's because we were carrying this guy.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not that big. You just say when you're going to a rice paddy that's full of water and you're sinking all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking 50, 80 pounds on your back without the VC.
Mm-hmm. Right.
All the equipment. So, we slowed up the platoon by doing that.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a body count, and everybody was happy.
did you guys think about that at all, or talk about that aspect at all?
About the body?
Well, the emphasis on the body count.
Yeah, we didn't. The platoon, the infantry guys, were no big thing about the body count for us, right? Because we shoot the DC. I mean, we're not going to bring them back. It wasn't a big thing to us, but it was a big thing to our higher ups. They like to see the body,
Mm-hmm.
It was. I don't know why. It's just they like the body count, the actual body count, and they just like seeing this stuff, And us as infantry, we've seen it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So to them, it was a big thing. To us, it was nothing.
Okay. When you would go out on these missions, how much of a mission brief would you receive?
Not much, really. We'd actually be a scramble. They call it a scramble.
Mm-hmm.
They say scramble the blues. When we're a scramble, we already knew it was either a chopper down or somebody's in trouble out there, some other infantry outfit.
Mm-hmm.
And if they had time, if our lieutenant had time and he got briefed on it, he would tell us what's going on. Like, we would just say chopper's down. VC is an area, so
mm-hmm.
we got to get in there.
Mm-hmm.
Or if somebody's in trouble, that's all they tell us. It wouldn't be anything, a big, a long briefing.
Mm-hmm.
We just knew we had to get out there as soon as possible.
What about enemy strength or composition in the area?
They would have no idea, because they knew there was enemy out there, but they wouldn't know how many or...
Mm-hmm.
Or who, the NBA or BC.
Mm-hmm.
It's just something you went in blind with.
Mm-hmm.
So they could have been a couple hundred, it could be a two.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't ever know.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, are there any particular missions that stick in mind in terms of, we do want to, of course, talk about what occurred on Hill 376, but I was just curious about other missions before that.
Oh, we had a few. We had one mission we went on. It was suspected bunker, VC bunker complex we went into. It was, we went in and there were tunnels and bunkers. We caught a few, I don't know what we called them at the time, and they were VC civilians, the families that we got. It was quite a few, you know, 10 or 15, with their babies and their wives, you know. And in the tunnels, we'd be kind of checking the area out, and we seen one tunnel, a VC ran by the tunnel with an infant, and we knew, so we knew the VC were in the tunnel, so we called in the engineer, a couple of engineer fits, they were explosive experts.
Mm-hmm.
They'd come out and blow these tunnels up. Well, I was behind this Sergeant Smith, which you have met down in Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
I was behind him. He was walking, and a VC threw a grenade out at us. And Smith kicked it back in. He threw it back out. Smith kicked back in. You know, I was right behind him watching the whole thing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, I opened up on the VC, you know. So he quit throwing that grenade back at us. So the grenade went off, and it just, everything just blew.
Mm.
I think it killed the two engineer guys and wounded a lot of our guys at different entrances, you know, entrance and outlets, exits of the tunnel there, because they're standing by.
Mm-hmm.
And had one guy lost his leg, blew his leg off, and another guy, he was Sergeant Couch, was splintered up pretty bad. He almost lost his one of his legs and arms, but apparently he saved them. And it was pretty bad. We lost, I think, one or two sergeants out of the deal too.
Mm-hmm.
Were killed. And that was one of them that stuck on my head. The sergeant lost his leg. He was pretty upset. He couldn't see that he lost it, but all he could ask was, do I have my leg? Do I have my leg? Because he said he always told his wife, that's one thing, he didn't want to go back home with missing limb.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he lost that leg. And that was one of the things that stuck out of my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And we had one where we did a recon called Razorback Ridge. It was
mm-hmm.
a two-week recon. We had to walk the whole mountain. And at one point, we stumbled across a lot of remains of bodies. Some flesh was still in the boots, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so my lieutenant called up and asked if they knew anything about this. He called up my CO. And he got back to us, and he said it was the 82nd Airborne was there, and they got overrun one night. And there's quite a few bodies around there, and I always wonder why they never went in and recovered them, you know, because there were skeletons left. And that's all he told us, and so we just kept moving on our recon,
mm-hmm.
you know, for a couple of weeks. One of those nights on that recon, we were attacked by monkeys.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they just, we set up camp, not realizing there's monkeys above us, and for some reason, during, it was about 1 in the morning, we were attacked by them. You know, so that was quite an experience. And just scared the heck out of us,
mm-hmm.
obviously. So all we can do is fight them off and grab them, because you really couldn't see, you know.
Yeah.
And the jungle is pitch black.
Right.
You know, you can't see a thing. So it was a scary situation.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't know what was happening. And that was probably those two of the things that stuck out in my head. You know, besides that one on April 12th when they called their own artillery on it.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Now, Did you have any other incidents involving wildlife besides the monkey and the scorpion bite?
Tigers.
Tigers?
Yeah, we ran into tigers in infantry combat talk. A tiger's in ambush. Okay, so mm-hmm. so I'm on the radio, and our scout on the chopper calls up and tells me you got a tiger in front of you. And I'm thinking there's an ambush in front of me. And I said, well, how many are there? He says, one. And I laughed. I said, well, that's not a tiger. It's a sniper, you know.
Uh-huh.
He says, no. He says, tiger. You know, we're only four legs. So that was more scary than an ambush to me, you know.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you know, a tiger can rip you apart.
Right.
So they scared it off.
And, okay.
A tiger and the snakes, of course. Obviously, you ran into a lot of snakes over there.
Mm-hmm.
And oh, that was about it. I mean, there's spottings of elephants, but I never seen an elephant
mm-hmm.
over there.
Mm-hmm.
But that was pretty much it as far as the wildlife
mm-hmm.
you know, and the monkeys.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, to your knowledge, did anybody go in after you guys got left Razorback to pick up those suspected bodies of the 82nd Airborne?
No, they didn't. You know what? When we was in Vietnam 2 years ago,
mm-hmm.
we, at Da Nang at the Parama Resort, ran into a search team, a missing in action for search team. They,
mm-hmm.
they were Americans,
mm-hmm.
and I told them about it. You know, and I told them I was always curious if they were missing. If they were listed as missing in action or KIA.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, I talked to the guy, and he never believed me about it.
Mm.
You know, he said that's impossible. They wouldn't leave a whole bunch of Americans out there. I said, well, okay, you know, you say that's possible, but I've seen it. You know, with my own eyes, I've seen it. And I had a friend that, in fact, he committed suicide shortly after Vietnam because he couldn't handle it.
Mm-hmm.
He even wrote me a letter about that, remembering seeing these guys,
mm-hmm.
you know, the bodies and the flesh and the boots and all that. So I kept in contact with this officer in charge of this MIA search,
mm-hmm.
and I kept asking him if they checked into it, you
mm-hmm.
know. And he come back and he'd email me back and say, well, no, the we think this was a battle of, you know, you give me a date and all that, and I think that was it. And, but he never checked, you know, they never actually went out to Razorback Ridge and checked it out. So, you know, looked at the remains, the skeletons and all that, and so he just kind of brushed me off. And he didn't believe me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was the final line, you know, that I got out of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he just wrote me off as I was crazy. Forget about it. So that was it. You know, I never pursued it after that.
Hmm.
So.
Okay. Well, why don't we go ahead and discuss the events that occurred on Hill 376?
Yeah, a bad day.
Mm-hmm.
It was a routine day. You know, this is where we were sent down to Chua Lai because we're having a lot of trouble down in the Chua Lai area. A lot of NBA action and everything, and they needed us down there as a rapid reaction team to recover all the down chopper pilots and down choppers. And they were looking for a big NBA unit
mm-hmm.
that was threatening that area to overrun the Marine Air Base down there and the AmeriCal Division Air Base Army. And that particular day, we just routinely flew out to Tempe, our staging area where we stayed, the infantry team would stay there and wait for the call for a down chopper to go in after them, you know. And around 10 o'clock, you know, I was sitting, me and some guys were sitting by the radio because we could hear our CEO. We hear all these chopper pilots calling in, a lot of activity in the area where they were at. And it was getting pretty intense, you know, like, were getting pretty nervous. Our medic, LaPointe, Joe LaPointe, was supposed to meet his wife and the newborn baby that he never got to see yet at Hawaii the next day. He was leaving for an hour. And he was pretty nervous about it because, you know, that was, he wanted to go see him. So.
Yeah.
And so I remember me and the other guy said, well, you know, just stay back. You know, stay back and we'll take care of things. It's no big thing. You know? We've been through this many times. You know, well, we won't need you out there. Well, you know, he had to get the okay from the lieutenant first, you know, because we were just guys. You know, we were just grunts. We had no say, so, you know, we couldn't decide who stayed back. But he wouldn't talk to the lieutenant. You know, he wasn't telling me he was nervous about this and he was going R&R the next day or anything. But that's what he wanted. He came along with us. When they scrambled us, they wanted us to go and check the activity out, you know, that they'd been seeing. And we went out there. They flew us out there and we circled the landing zone for quite a while while they had Cobra. The gunships were firing up the other rockets, you know, to make sure it was a safe landing. And as we were going in, finally, because we was really getting nervous then, because we just circled it, and looking down at that landing zone, you know, all the firepower going into that, and so we were getting pretty nervous about it. And we all pretty much knew this was going to be intense, you know, because there was just a lot of prepping going on. And we all had that feeling that, you know, something was really going to happen. And we finally landed, and I understand we were fired at all the way in, which we call it a hot LZ. We see the fire going in. And we finally landed, and once the last chopper dropped off the last of our platoon, we started down one side of the hill. And we see a lot of small weapons fire coming up at us, you know. And so my lieutenant called up the company commander. You know, he like to say he always flies above us. And he said, we're seeing a great deal of fire, small weapons fire. What do you want us to do next? And he said, well, just turn around and go to the other side of the hill. You know, go down the other side of the hill. And so we all turned around and meet two sergeants at the point, Sergeant Reed and Sergeant Saunders, first point man. And we was going down the hill, and, you know, and I'm thinking, well, there's obviously VC or NBA in the area because we were receiving fire. And I'm hoping the point men are alert to all this, you know. You're hoping to do a good job at point. So we get down to this clearing by some boulders, me and the lieutenant and the other radio operator. We're by these boulders, three big boulders, and then I hear Sergeant Saunders. He yells, hey, you know, we got a chicken over here, you know, and he's laughing about it. And Sergeant Reed start chasing the chicken. They're just laughing. And their chicken took him right into a bunker copter. And they just opened fire on him. And all of a sudden you heard Saunders and Reed start yelling, you know, I'm hit, medic. Just screaming away, you know, and our medic, Joe, was behind me. And he starts taking off, and me and Carter, the other radio man, yell at him to hold up, you know, we got to secure this area first, but he kept going. And he went in there, and he was trying to help him out, and pretty soon he heard more firing. The mate got hit, you know, and Lieutenant Burke sent in Albert Bumstead to check it out, and Bumstead ran right in there. And pretty soon he ran back. He was running right towards us. And as he's running back, the upper left part of his chest just blew out. An MBA shot him through the back and blew out part of his chest above his heart. So we grabbed him, from behind the boulders, you know. And he was still alive, and as a matter of fact, he did make it. He made it back home, I think. Bumpster was telling me that when he ran in there, all this firing was going on, and he was trying to find a place to hide, you know, take cover. And he seen this one guy, he thought it was a Kit Carson scout, hiding under a bush, so he thought he'd get in there with him. Well, it turned out to be an MBA. He was hiding in there with him, you know. And he said, once you realize it, it shocked him, shocked that soldier, MBA soldier. And then he got up and started running, and that's when that guy shot him through the back, you know. And I remember when he shot him, it just barely missed mine and Lieutenant Burke's and Cotter's head, because you hear the round snapping above your head.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we all three of us were lucky we didn't get hit in the head, you know. And then, you know, all hell broke loose. You know, we tried to get in the line to assault these bunkers that ambushed them. But by then, there's too many of the guys shot, killed, and wounded. So, you know, we had nobody up front. Sergeant Fleming got shot in the leg, and almost shot one leg off. He was yelling and screaming, and I remember our machine gunner was in shock at the time, and he was crying and yelling, and I was yelling at him to get his act together, you know, because, you know, we're in pretty bad shape. So I gave my radio. My lieutenant and Cotter and Bumpstead were behind these big boulders, you know. And I gave my radio to the lieutenant. I said, you know, I got to get up there to Fleming. He's hit pretty bad. So, you know, he was by himself. So I crawled up there, and I seen his leg was just hanging on by flesh, you know, and his other leg was pretty well shot up. So I didn't know who was ahead of me anymore. You know, I knew there was all these guys that were, I knew there was three guys wounded pretty bad, which was the two sergeants and our medic. And I seen one guy right in front of me. His name was Richard Breck. He was leaning against the tree, shooting, firing away. And I looked up the hill right in front of us, and I see all these NBA coming down towards us, you know. And they're firing us, and oh, man, you know. I was looking for Snyder, and I thought he was dead. Because I couldn't see him, I couldn't hear him or anything. And so we was firing up above the hill, trying to keep the NBA back. And pretty soon I see our artillery guy. His name was Dennis Prince. He was right up there by the two sergeants and the medic. And I thought he was going to put a grenade into one of those bunkers. And next thing I knew, you know, he stood straight up, and he was trying to get into the our wounded, the sergeant and the medic, and he stood straight up, and I thought, oh man. And pretty soon this NBA opened up with his machine gun, just got him across the chest, and he went down. I mean, I just watched him go down, and that was it for him, because he got him right through the heart. And then I looked to my right where Breck was. Just as I looked to him, I looked at him. He got a round right between the eyes. And it just blew his brain back into my face, you know. So I had Fleming there. He was laying on his back, you know. And I started to move up to Breck because he had a radio. And Fleming started yelling, you know, don't leave me, and, you know, what am I going to do? I had to do something. So I finally made it to Breck, and I took his knife out, and I cut off his radio, and I pulled it back, you know, to where Fleming was, back behind. And I changed the frequency to my lieutenant, you know, where my old radio, where he had my radio.
And I called them up. I said, you know, we're in really bad shape here. We've got a lot of guys KIA'd and wounded, and the VCR and the NBA are coming down at it. You know, I said, Charlie's coming down at it. And, I mean, there's a bunch of them. You know, just a bunch coming down. And he said, well, pull back to where I'm at. Well, I couldn't because I was pinned down in that area. And I couldn't leave Fleming because they, you know, couldn't be moved. You know, so I just, I said, I'm staying up here with Fleming. I can't go anywhere. And then the Clovers were coming in with their guns, you know, firing rockets up the hill, trying to help keep the NBA back. And pretty soon I hear Snyder. Snyder was yelling my name. And he said, man, I'm over here, I'm pinned down. He's right under the bunker. And he was kind of out of sight of the NBA in the bunker. And the NBA started throwing rocks at him so they can get him to move, you know, and so they can get a clear shot at him. And he wouldn't move. But he said to cover me, man, I got to get out of here because you can hear the NBA then. By then, they're yelling, Chu Ahoy, which was, they're yelling at us, Chu Ahoy was to surrender.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's how close we were to being killed or captured. So I really couldn't see Snyder because the grass there pretty high. So I just, you know, I estimated where he was at, and I just opened fire right above him, you know, hoping I wouldn't hit him. And I fired right above him, and then I can see him crawling out. I can see the grass moving where he's crawling out. And he finally got out of there. And then I directed my fire up to the hill for the NBA, you know, firing up, trying to get the NBA to, you know, hold them back and everything. And I was on the radio with, turned out to be Ken Barwick, a gunship pilot. And apparently Lieutenant Burke was talking to the pilots, trying to direct fire, where to fire. And when I got on the radio, I knew pretty much where everybody was at by then. And I was, at the time, I was popping smoke so they wouldn't hit us, you know. And I was directing fire through the radio to Ken Barwick, telling them where to fire and where we were at. You know, I tell them to look for the color of smoke and tell them that's where we were at, and not to shoot there, but shoot as close as you can because they're right on us, you know. And, of course, after all these years, I learned 2 years ago that was Ken Barwick I was talking to, you know. Found out that when we went back to Vietnam 2 years ago, I found out that was him I was actually talking to, and is one of our lifesavers, you know. And through the day, we ran out of ammunition, and I called up. Of course, I told him, I said, you know, I'm out of ammo, because I went and got all the ammo I could off the wounded and the dead, and pulled back and just used our ammo up. And when I called that up, Fernando De Paris, our lift pilot, you know, the guy that called us in there, he volunteered to take ammo to us. And he actually asked for single men to volunteer because he really didn't think he was going to come back alive. So he asked for single volunteers only, but he told me that everybody volunteered to go in to fly with him and at least bring our resupply of ammo in. And they finally made it out to the ammo, and they kicked it out above us. I don't know why. We can't ever figure out why they never got shot down, but we kind of guessed that they just didn't want to give away their position. So when they kicked the ammo out, I called up and went and got it, and you know, made sure I pulled back. And it was actually two of us left fighting off the NBA, is me and Detmar Snyder, because Burke and Cotter were pinned down behind the boulders, and Barker was there too. And they were all pinned down behind the boulders behind us. And it was just me and Snyder up front fighting. And of course, it started raining. This was going on for hours.
started raining, and pretty much thought, you know, that we were dead, you know, because it started raining, the chopper can't come out in the rain, you know, cloud covers are low, and the cloud ceiling is low, and, you know, I just, I figured that we weren't going to make it at all, because we had no more big gun support from the gunships and all that. And finally, the rain cleared out, the clouds moved up, and they brought in reinforcements. They brought in, I think, the 501 Infantry of the 101st. And I could hear all these choppers coming. And I seen them rounding the hill where we landed, where they landed us, and there was just chopper after chopper. And they fought their way down to us, and they finally broke us free, you know. And I remember Snyder, after it was all over, Snyder came over to me. I always carried two canteens on my back, you know, my web gear. And Snyder says, "Hey, you know, give me a drink of water." So I pulled my canteens out, and they're all full of holes. So they're shooting pretty close. You know. Mm-hmm. And they just finally fight their way down to us and broke us free. They took out the wounded first because it was already getting dark. It was pretty almost dark, you know. They took the wounded out because that's all he had time to burn. And we set up a perimeter for the night, and we laid there all through the night with our dead, and had a firefight parts of the night because the enemy tried to come up on our positions, you know. And they had a what we call spooky. There's a C-130 plane that flew around us all night, firing up mini machine guns all through the night. And these machine guns fire about 1,200 rounds per square foot. You know, so it was probably one of the longest nights in my time in Vietnam. You know, and the next morning about, you know, I can't remember 10, 11 o'clock. They finally pulled us out that we're left alive and the dead out. And we went back to our staging area, and they debriefed us. And then we got word that those 250 guys that came out and reinforced us, they were pinned down, you know. And so then we started to realize there's more NVA out there than we thought, because there's 250 of our guys out there getting pinned down, and they only inserted 18 of us the day before. So after a couple months or so, we find out there's approximately 2,000 NVA in the whole area, and that was the NVA company they were looking for all the time. I was threatening Marine Air Base out there, and we were the unlucky ones to find them. So that was pretty much it. You know, it was a pretty bad situation we got put into. You know.
Well. What was the biggest lesson you learned from that particular operation?
Well, you know, a lot of it was just alertness, you know. You got to remind everybody constantly, you got to be alert at any situation you're in, you know. God is... I learned a lot of stuff that I had to think a lot better than I did that day, because we was kind of lax on our alertness.
Mm-hmm.
Situations, you know, when the doc ran in there, we should have grabbed him.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody should have grabbed him before we had more casualties, you know, and just say don't go into her, you know, just be more aggressive on stopping certain situations. Well, I also learned life is, you can lose a life real easy. It don't take much to to stop a life, you know. Mm-hmm. Like that day, I mean, it was just incredible. The part watching, I mean, I witnessed you guys being killed, you know. Mm-hmm. Just watching them dropping left and right, you know. I was killing NBA myself. I was picking them out and shooting them and dropping them. And it was just, it's amazing how you can just shoot somebody and they die, you know. And that's what I was thinking, you know, the day after.
Mm-hmm.
So, man, I mean, this, you know, I was in shock for days after that.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just one of those big battles that we almost got captured, you know. Me and Snyder almost got captured, and, you know, almost lost our lives. We lost five guys right off the bat, you know, and we were killed, and then we had all the other wounded. So, and then, you know, we had a pilot come in, a jet pilot come in with bombing the other side of the hill to keep the other MVAs back. And we had to call him off because he was dropping the big bombs and he was receiving shrapnel on our side, so they were starting to hit us. We had one guy wounded by the shrapnel from the bombs on the other side. So we had to call them off too, you know. And it was, I think our CO learned a lesson by they got to check the area out a little bit better, a lot better, and you just don't throw 18 guys in there and think there isn't much in there, you know.
Right.
Turned out we just got wiped out.
The use of the phrase Chuhoy while you were there, of course, typically that was used by the Vietnamese to surrender themselves.
Right.
But in this instance, they were calling for your surrender.
Right.
Okay. Had that happened to you before or since?
No. Okay. That was the only time that we were so close to getting captured.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What were the total losses for your unit?
That day,
mm-hmm.
there was five killed. Fleming. Two wounded, for sure. Oh, yeah, there was five killed, two wounded. And we had two Kid Carson scouts that were with us.
Mm-hmm.
They defected.
Defected to the other side?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, during the battle.
Wow.
Yeah. So we lost nine.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, the enemy strength, did you guys ever get a good handle on exactly how many enemy you were going up against?
Probably... immediate on above us, there's probably around 200, I think.
Wow.
They thought. And then throughout the hill and the valley, they say there's 2,000 NVA. Because they did end up sending, there's about 450 American infantrymen out there, and they were pinned down for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can, that's a good scale to measure by. There's 450 of them pinned down, and there's 18 of us that went in originally.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't have a fighting chance.
Mm-mm.
You know.
Not at all.
So we're just lucky that they didn't know how many of us were left,
mm-hmm.
or else they could have just overran us,
mm-hmm.
you know, with no problem. You know, of course, we would have went down fighting, you know, but still they would have overran us.
Mm-hmm. How much time elapsed until you went on your next mission?
It took us a while to get reinforced. You know, until probably a total of 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because we lost so many, and there was guys that were back in the rear that had guard duty the night before, so they didn't come out with us. There's probably three guys. So they couldn't go out in the field with us that day. And so there was there was 11 of us left.
Mm-hmm.
And, not 11 or 12. So we couldn't, only way they would use us, it was in a dire emergency where a pilot was down and the VC were
closing in on them. That's the only time they would use us before we got reinforced. And we finally got reinforced with a lot of new, we call them at the time shake and bakes, or sergeants that went to basic and AIT, and then went to NCO training, and they came out sergeants, buck sergeants. So that's why we call them bacon shakes or instant sergeants. So we had a lot of new guys like that, and we shipped a couple veterans over to us, you know, to help us out. Because by then I was, me and a couple other guys, where we were vets. We were broke in vets, so we knew what we were doing, and we just knew an all new guy, and they gave us a few vets that were in other companies, and we had to break in those the new sergeants that came in straight out of the States, you know, and they kind of didn't like that, you know, because we was, I mean, I wasn't a sergeant at the time, I was Spec 4, and he didn't like me or other guys, Tom, telling them what to do because they were sergeants. So we had to kind of discipline them because, you know, either they listen to us or they die, you know. So we explained to them that everything you learned back in the States in the book, just forget about it. You know, it's a new ball game out here. This is combat. And either you listen to us or you're not going to make it back. So they didn't like the idea, and some listened to it, and a couple that wouldn't. They just thought they're a sergeant, and you can't tell me how to fight a war. Okay, you know, be that way. So obviously, a couple of these guys didn't make it back, you know, because they wanted, you know, do it by the book, and they didn't make it back.
Did that kind of conflict ever result in fragging or anything like that?
Fragging? Oh, yeah. Yeah, we had fights. Actual fist fights. Ragging and, you know, fist fights because they, you know, between us and the NCO, you know.
No, but did any NCOs ever get killed as a result?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Fragging.
Fragging. No.
Fragging, yeah.
No.
Okay.
No, we, no.
But there were fist fights.
Yeah.
You guys are getting fist fights over this stuff.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. The couple of sergeants just couldn't understand why we had to, you know, tell them how to fight this war, you know. And we get in our heated arguments and end up fist fighting.
Wow.
So, but you know, at the end, we, you know, we're all good buddies. You know, it's just something that we had to make them understand. And after their first big firefight, they woke up, you know, and pretty soon we're good buddies, and, you know, we learned how to depend on each other, you know. So it wasn't like we hated each other through the rest of the tour, you know.
Okay. It's just that breaking in process.
Yep.
You got to break them in.
Yeah, exactly.
What about the lieutenants that you had come in to your platoon over the course of time? Did they get better, worse? I know you mentioned that the first one was probably the best, but
you know, they got better. You know, it was worse at the beginning. We had a couple lieutenants and a captain that were, like, say, special force, ex-special forces, and they were pretty bad. It was really, really gung-ho, where the body count was all that mattered to them, and then you know. And then they get rid of them. Our CO would get rid of them. And then it got better because we would get seasoned veterans, you know, that come in, they had level heads, and they were young guys like us, you know, young lieutenants like us, and they were level headed, and they knew exactly what to do, and then we had a lot of confidence in them, you know, they're good guys. And we lost a couple because they were wounded, you know. But they got better at the end.
Okay. And what about the morale of the unit and the ethnic makeup of the unit? How did it change over time, and was it ever affected?
Morale was pretty good after a while.
When we went down to Tulare area,
mm-hmm.
it was pretty bad. You know, there a lot of guys getting knocked off left and right because it was a very intense area. A lot of BC, a lot of NBA, and the guys are really getting scared. You know, they just knew they weren't going to make it out of the mission. You know,
mm-hmm.
so it wasn't very good. But later on, you know, it got better as we got a reinforcements and we trained them. On combat,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, we taught them. The seasoned veterans taught them, and morale was good. We had a good bunch of guys. Ethnic back, you know, we had guys that it was a lot of. In Vietnam, there's a lot of racism,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I never knew what. You know, I come from a small town. I didn't know what racism was as far as black.
Mm-hmm.
I knew what racism was as far as Mexicans. It was, you know, in school, I ran into a lot of racism between the whites and the Mexicans.
Mm-hmm.
But I never knew a black, you know,
mm-hmm.
so I didn't think much of it. But a lot of these guys that come from Detroit, Chicago, blacks and whites, well, there's a lot of racism between them,
mm-hmm.
you know. And I really, us small town guys didn't know that.
mm-hmm.
You know, we were learning as we was going along that, geez, man, there is a lot of racism here, and they're vocal about it too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because you hear the name calling and all that, and I thought, man, you know, we're fighting two wars over here right now. So it wasn't very good,
mm-hmm.
you know. And some of the guys that were having a lot of race, you know, problems had left, and it turned out we in our platoon, we all got along pretty well after some of these other guys left. They were causing a lot of problems
mm-hmm.
with the racism. You know. So it turned out that towards the end of my tour over there, everybody got along real well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What did you guys do for recreation? Anything?
You know, we had R&R. You know, some of us go to Bangkok or Hong Kong. Once in a while, we get a, like, two-day pass.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole platoon, or we would go to a place called Eagle Beach outside of Wei,
mm-hmm.
by the China Sea.
Mm-hmm.
And we spend a couple days there, and then that would be it. As far as recreation and camp, there was no recreation.
Mm.
You know, there's nothing like that. You had movies at night. You go down to the theater. It's an outside theater.
Mm-hmm.
Watch a movie or something. A lot of drinking. Everybody drank like fish, you know.
Mm-hmm. What did you drink?
Just beer.
Okay.
Beer. Well, you know, some guys drink hard alcohol. For myself and most of my buddies would drink beer. So every chance you got, you had to stand down and you drink yourself
mm-hmm.
silly.
How about other things, drugs or anything?
Oh, there's a lot of drugs up there. I've seen, you know, bags and bags of marijuana, you know, that the Vietnamese civilians would sell to the Americans.
Mm-hmm.
My platoon, there's probably just a couple guys that smoked marijuana,
mm-hmm.
and that was about it. But you know, I've heard stories of guys in the unit, not infantry, but you know, the machine gunners, and I mean the maintenance guys and all that, that there is heroin and all that going around. But I never seen it. You know.
Mm-hmm. In your unit, it was only a couple of people that smoked marijuana.
Yeah, my platoon.
In your platoon.
Yeah.
Were there strict? Was there an attempt to strictly enforce the rules regarding that?
No. I never seen anything like that. And they never give us any kind of talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if they looked the other way or they just didn't think there was much all going on.
Yeah.
in the minute. You know,
mm-hmm.
I think the biggest problem, grass is a big thing. I think the alcohol was the big thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody drank heavily.
Mm-hmm.
You know, forget the problem. Forget the war.
Were there rules about that?
No, they didn't say anything about that.
Hmm.
You know, just everybody drank.
Mm-hmm.
Very few people drank. You know, officers. If anybody didn't drink, it'd be some of the officers because they, you know, some knew better.
Mm-hmm.
Us infantry guys, we was a bunch of alcoholics. You know.
Now, of course, some people might think that you're saying that in jest. Do you think that did become a problem for some people?
Oh, yeah. Back in the States, I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, yeah. There's a lot of that went on. I mean, to this day, you know. You got a lot of guys that are in bad shape because of the drinking problems and even the drug problems.
Mm-hmm.
You know. So it caused a lot of problems in their personal life.
Yeah.
You know. So it's one of those, you know, a lot of them still going through counseling.
Mm-hmm.
You know. So they use it as something to forget.
Mm-hmm. You know. Okay. Now, did you stay? No, you didn't. You moved around a little bit. You went from Hue down to Quang Tri, Chulai, and Tam Ki.
Right.
Okay. As you were moving into those different areas, I guess, how much time did you spend in Quang Tri?
Quang Tri was just, you know, a couple of days. We just worked the whole area.
Okay.
You know, Chulai was a 90-day thing.
90 days?
Yeah.
And you mentioned that there was quite a bit of activity there.
Yeah. That was a very hot area.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was during Hamburger Hill.
Okay. Any particular operations that stand out?
No, I just went down to Hawaii. That was the big one. The Lamar plan was the operation.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the big one where we lost a lot of people, you know, a lot of helicopters, a lot of pilots, you know, were killed in that area.
Mm-hmm.
That was probably the main one.
Okay. And how about at Tam Ki?
Yeah, that was the same area.
Oh, that is the same area.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, Tam Ki was just our staging area.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, are there any other operations or activities in Vietnam that you want to discuss?
So, that was about it as far as, you know, everything was routine most of the time, going out, doing recons. We captured nurses, enemy nurses. We captured officers, high-ranking officers, NBA officers that had a lot of intelligence information on them, you know, paperwork and everything that we was proud of anyway, because it helped out the U.S. a lot, you know, with this intelligence, you know.
In what areas did you capture officers?
You know, it was out in the Oshawa Valley in the jungle.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't tell you exactly what area, but we...
How about time frame?
It's probably around July and August of 69. That time, you know. And we've captured a lot of VC, you know, and just, you know, a lot of routine stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Just a couple big battles, like I just told you. But that was about it.
Now, when you captured either VC or NVA officers or whoever, was it difficult at times to restrain people from?
No, actually not.
Hmm.
No, they were willing to go.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if they wanted a chopper, and chopper would take them back to intelligence. Mm-hmm. You know, got them off there. And that's less we obviously heard of, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But, that was about it.
Okay. And how about restraining your fellow soldiers not to do physical harm to the captured?
Yeah, we never had that problem
in
my outfit.
Okay.
You know, I've heard they did in other outfits, but no, we just capture them. And we throw them on the chopper from what happened from that point, actually, from the chopper, I have no idea.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't do no beatings or anything like that. You know, we found babies out in the jungle. You know, where for a medic, we use big gauze for a diaper and all that.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Wow.
And they're just left out there. The babies are. And they take them back to end up at an orphanage somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Goodness.
It was different things. We had to sit through one rain the month of April of 69. It rained either 72 or 82 inches in that month.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a hard time with that, you know. It was, you know, sleeping in the water and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of people don't realize what we had to go through. Besides combat, you had,
mm-hmm.
you had all the other elements, like, you know, the scorpions and
mm-hmm.
tigers and monkeys and all that. So we had a lot of elements. You had a battle, you know,
mm-hmm.
the rain, the cold nights out in the jungle and the rain and all that stuff. So it was a lot of stuff involved in being in combat.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty much it.
Okay. Now, let's see. When you were getting close to your departure date, the DROS.
Yeah.
Did anything change for you operationally?
Oh yeah, you know, when you always get close to your leaving Vietnam, ending your tour, you get very nervous, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And about 10 days before you leave, before your ending date, they pull you out of the field because they know you're real nervous, you're anxious, you know, anxiety's high. And, you know, you made it that far, you know, through your tour, they want to pull you out and make sure you go home alive, you know,
mm-hmm.
after 10 days left. And I guess I got to add is that about my fifth day, I had about four or five days left before I returned home. My XO, the next down from company, the second command of my company,
mm-hmm.
name is Captain Dave Livingston. Very good guy. I really admired him over there. Just a great guy. He got shot down. And he got shot in the head. He was a loach. At the time, he became a scout leader for the loaches, you know, the low observation choppers. He got shot in the head. He went down in a thick jungle. And like I say, I had 4 or 5 days left. And the platoon sergeant came up to me and said, you know, Livingston is down out there, and there's not that many qualified repellers to go in after him. You know, you want to go with him? And, well, you know, I said, sure, you know, this is Livingston. You know, he's a good man. And so we went out there, and we repelled in, and it turned out that a lot of us ran out of rope because the jungle was deeper than we thought. Some guys got hurt pretty bad, broken ankles.
Mm-hmm.
One guy got his head split open because they threw out a box of grenades and he got hit in the head and split his head open. He lived, but he was there pretty bad.
Mm-hmm.
And I ran out of rope. You know, I had the radio on my back, ran out of rope, and a tree fell, I don't know how many feet, quite a few feet. And hurt myself a little bit. And we got the captain out and his door gunner. But I thought he was dead. And after all these years, I thought he was killed.
Mm-hmm.
Find out he just lives about 60 miles south of me.
Oh, no.
Yeah, and I went down to visit him. Well, he's paralyzed on the left side.
Okay.
You know, and he showed me his wound on his head and all that, where he got shot. We spend the night there, and through the night, there was one guy that was still caught up in the tree,
mm-hmm.
and we couldn't get him down because it was already almost dark. And through the whole night, we had about maybe 150 MBA walk right by us, about 10 feet away.
Right.
And we couldn't see, you know, we had to be real quiet.
Mm-hmm.
And he was called, you know, I called this in to our company commander in the night. I said, you know, we had NBA, and I was turning off my squelch on my radio because if they heard that, then it would be dead meat.
Mm-hmm.
And we made it through the night with no problems, you know, no casualties or anything, anybody get shot. And they,
medevac guys ever heard out and pulled the rest of us out. We had to move wire out of there because we couldn't land anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And made it back and had about 3 days left before I went home.
Mm-hmm. Now, how did Livingston get out?
Medevac.
Okay. He was medevac too.
Yeah.
He just, okay.
Yeah, we got him out that night.
You got him out, but you just didn't realize he survived.
Right.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, just out of curiosity, in terms of, I asked previously about recreation, did you guys have any radios? You listen to radio programs,
yeah.
Music and stuff?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we had radios, transistor radios and
mm-hmm.
all that.
Mm-hmm.
We never had them out with us in the field. It was just back at camp.
How frequently would you be able to listen to programs?
Whenever we went back there.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever we went back and, mm-hmm. At base and sat around.
Mm-hmm. Was that important for you guys?
Oh, yeah.
How so?
Well, you like the music, you like the news, listen to the news,
mm-hmm.
And you had to have something to listen to. A lot of guys, of course, had real tape recorders that they listened to their music on.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of that, and I mostly listen to the radio,
mm-hmm.
Listen to the broadcast, U.S. Armed Forces broadcast,
mm-hmm.
and music, and that was important, you relax by that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And would you guys have, would you have uninterrupted access to broadcasts, or was it kind of difficult at times to get the...
Yeah, it was in uninterrupted.
Okay.
Yeah, never a problem.
Okay. So reception was good?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, is there anything else you'd like to talk about in terms of your in-country experiences?
No, that's pretty much it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, when you left, did you feel like you'd accomplished anything?
No. No, when I left, I was proud of the fact that I helped save lives.
Mm-hmm.
I saved my buddy's life, somebody, and some saved my life,
mm-hmm.
and things like that. That was a proud thing I was proud of.
Mm-hmm.
as far as accomplishing anything over there, not really.
Okay.
There's always NDA, always DC, you never ran out of them. So you didn't. Yeah, I don't think we did any help. As far as winning the battle.
Mm-hmm. Well, did you? You mentioned you never ran out of enemy.
Yeah.
Did you ever run out of anything you needed? You guys ever short of anything? Supplies or anything?
Beer.
Beer.
No, not really.
Okay.
We never really ran out of anything.
Okay.
We was pretty well supplied with, mm-hmm. with pretty much everything we needed. We were jealous of the fact that the Air Force and the Marines they got really good food. We found out they were eating steaks and everything. I never seen one steak over there.
Mm-hmm.
I never seen one hamburger over there until I was going on R&R in the Air Force, leaving an Air Force base,
mm-hmm.
Cameron Bay. Or down by Saigon, I seen steak there, but as far as our camp, we didn't see anything like that. We heard, we find out these guys are eating steaks, and the Air Force, and a lot of these rear echelon guys, and I thought, man, they treat these guys good when we're out there fighting in the jungles,
Mm-hmm.
But we were kind of envious of those guys, but they were eating good.
Mm-hmm.
We were just eating your powdered eggs and sea rations,
Yeah. Okay. Well, when you got back, what was the trip like when you came back, and what was it like when you landed and arrived in the U.S.?
The trip was pretty quiet all the way back from Vietnam. We left Cameron Bay, flew to Japan, refueled there, and I landed in Port Lewis, Washington. We got off. Of course, you're happier and happier. And you finally made it back to stateside.
Mm-hmm.
And we get off the plane, and there's a fence around there. There is protesters meeting us there, throwing tomatoes at us, yelling at us, baby killers, and warmongers, And I thought, man, you know, this is our homecoming right here. Pretty disappointing.
Mm-hmm.
So you really got a bitter feeling towards these Americans that were knocking us down, you know. And so we just, you know, we just went on and did our processing out of the service.
Mm-hmm.
And finally got to get home about 5 in the morning, you know, flew to Denver. Made it home on the farm about 5 that morning.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it wasn't a very good homecoming.
Mm-hmm. When you got home, were you able to talk with your family at all about your experiences?
Not really.
Yeah.
You know, it's something you didn't want to talk about at the time. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, it was you wanted your time to think,
mm-hmm.
you know. You didn't really talk about it. As veterans, combat veterans, we found out that we didn't have this homecoming
mm-hmm.
that we expected. And we couldn't talk to anybody because we were called baby killers and murderers and all that. So most of us kind of like went underground and we just kept to ourselves and
mm-hmm.
kept quiet, you know, because you were already embarrassed.
Mm-hmm.
By being a Vietnam vet,
mm-hmm.
you know, we were no heroes.
What did you do for employment when you got back?
I was on the farm.
Okay.
Worked on the farm, my dad, my brothers. You know, we was about it on his farm.
How long did you do that?
I did it for off and on. Farm for up till about 76.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was too busy partying.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was welcoming myself home, you know, with my drink and everything. And ended up joining the post office
mm-hmm.
after that. I joined the post office in 72, and I got out, bought my dad's part of the farm out, and realized I didn't like that. So in 81, I rejoined the post office, and I've been
mm-hmm.
there ever since.
Okay. Now, and you didn't have a hard time finding employment at the post office?
No.
Okay. You know, I forgot to ask you a question about another aspect of your in-country experience. When you were in base camp, did you guys get shelled or rocketed, mortared very often?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we have call it incoming.
Uh-huh.
We get mortared every once in a while. We
mm-hmm.
get we get rocket attack once in a while.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we get sappers at our perimeter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, VC or try to penetrate a perimeter. Things like that. It wasn't very serious.
How would you typically respond?
You know, they just the alarm go off.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we knew something was going on. And if it's a rocket attack, we just hit for our bunkers. You know,
mm-hmm.
Which were right outside our hooches. And if it was a perimeter attack, we just stand by.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. You know, we let the guards at the perimeter take care of it, and they send out cobras
mm-hmm.
out to the perimeter and start blowing up the area. But it was nothing serious, really.
Okay. Back to your post-war experiences. When you what did you think when the war came to an end? Technically, in 73. With the Paris Peace Accords and the American complete withdrawal?
Well, I thought we lost all for naught. You know,
okay.
We lost all these lives, and we lost the war that we, a lot of, you know, over 58,000 men lost their lives for. It was all for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we fought for the South Vietnamese people, and they couldn't fight for themselves when we pulled out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, So they just didn't want the country bad enough to fight for it. So I just thought it was a complete loss of lives, and, loss of lives, and a lot of heartbreak for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and, I was disappointed in the South Vietnamese Army because they didn't want to fight that hard. You know, there's times that we would fight with. The Arvins, the Republic of Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
recruit, and this time they wouldn't want to get off the chopper. And we would go on the field with them. They had to kick them out, you know. So I thought, you know, this is pretty sad that we're fighting for them, and they don't want to fight with us. So
that happened in operations you conducted with our...
Yeah.
But they wouldn't... They didn't want to get off the choppers.
Right.
When you said they kick them off, usually was that just...
Well, they push them off.
Right there at the LZ?
Yeah.
Do you know if that ever happened from altitude?
No.
Okay.
No. Well, I don't know if it happened.
But you never witnessed it yourself?
Never witnessed, no.
Yeah. When you... has your attitude all changed over time?
Not really. I took a lot of pride in what I did over there, and a lot of pride in my fellow soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you still feel the loss of those guys that were killed over there, your buddies.
Mm-hmm.
You know. But I have a lot of pride in my unit in America.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a great country, and I fought with these guys, and I fight with them again.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
What about your attitude towards Vietnam?
Now, you know, I wish we never got in that mess, because when we went over there 2 years ago, those people are happy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at least they seem happy to me, and there was peace over there, and even though it was a communist country, they seem to be enjoying life.
Mm-hmm.
You know. So I wish we never got involved. I wish we just would have left them alone, and I think they would have peace a lot sooner.
Mm-hmm.
And we got involved. You know.
Well, you said you went back a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Were you surprised by anything?
Just by the happiness of the mm-hmm. people over there. You know, they're all happy, because I expected to be in a communist country, everybody be tense,
mm-hmm.
unhappy, because they have to live by the communist rule,
mm-hmm.
and all that. But everybody's life goes on as usual. Everybody's happy, working.
Mm-hmm.
You know, of course, you get your poor. It's a lot more poorer now since America pulled out of there. You know, so they relied on the U.S. money and jobs.
Mm-hmm.
But I was just surprised by how happy they are.
Mm-hmm. How about your treatment? How did they treat you?
Oh, they treated us great.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they thought we were great people. They treated us really good all the time.
Yeah.
Even the army did. I mean, we ran into the communist army, and they were nice to us. And we never had a problem.
Did that surprise you?
Yeah, it did, because I expected the dirty looks,
mm-hmm.
any kind of gesture that we weren't wanted there.
Yeah.
But no, they were good. That was surprising.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what was the most important thing you took away from that experience personally?
Oh God.
That is your experience, fighting in Vietnam.
The camaraderie that we had over there with the guys that we trained together for months. That was very important to me, you know, and how easy it is to lose your life, to learn that,
mm-hmm.
you know, through all the combat. That's a hard one to say, you know. There's just a lot of things that I take pride in now.
Mm-hmm.
My ex-combat buddy. It's kind of tough
mm-hmm.
to explain.
What do you think we as a nation should take away from the Vietnam War experience?
Don't get involved with something that a country don't want to fight, help themselves fight with. You know? We just leave them alone, unless it's like Kosovo, where they're murdering innocent people, you know. In Vietnam, I don't think they were really murdering innocent people. They just wanted to make it one country, you know, and they didn't, maybe they were killing innocent people, politicians and all that, maybe,
sure, but Coast Guard is a lot worse. They're just killing civilians, you know, innocent people. And if that was the part of the things that North Vietnam wanted to do, killing some people, they would have killed a lot of them by now. They would still be killing them. You know, but the one thing won the war, and everything was what, you know, everybody's left alone. You know, they just got to live by their laws, and that's it. So everybody's happy.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything else you'd like to talk about today?
No. That's pretty much it.
Okay. Well, this will end the interview with Jared Baltazar. Thank you very much, sir.